This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and you can watch our TV program on Free Speech TV and on our website. A U.S. District Court judge over the weekend issued the strongest stay on Donald Trump's Muslim ban that had turned away thousands of refugees, valid visa holders, and even some green card holders from U.S. airports. The ruling by Judge James Robart, who had been appointed by President George W. Bush, was the most wide-ranging of the slew of rulings in response to myriad lawsuits against Trump's executive order. It required the travel ban to be suspended immediately and nationwide. In response, Trump fired off a predictably childish tweet referring to Robart as a, quote, so-called judge, deeming his ruling ridiculous and vowing that it would be overturned. My guest is Caitlin Sanderson. She's a staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California's Orange County office. She's also the founding board president of the Immigrant Defenders Law Center. Welcome to the program, Caitlin.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, before we get into the ways in which ordinary people have been impacted by this ban and what you and other lawyers have done about it, let's talk about the legalities and the importance of this latest ruling. Almost right from the start, in the first weekend that the ban was in place, there was a ruling in response to an ACLU lawsuit. There have been a number of rulings. How is this one by Robart different from the previous ones?
So this ruling by Robart is the clearest and the most far-reaching. So, for example, there was a ruling in Boston, Massachusetts, after the ACLU of Massachusetts filed with respect to Logan Airport that was fairly far-reaching, but there was some question as to whether or not it applied nationwide. Similarly, in the Eastern District of Virginia, there was a ruling that applied to Dulles Airport, but again, it didn't apply across the nation. Additionally, some of the rulings, they only applied to certain categories of immigrants and perhaps not to refugees. The Washington State ruling applies to all of the explicitly applies nationwide, and it applies to all of the parts of the executive order that would affect the ability of those with valid immigrant and what we call non-immigrant visas to enter the United States, as well as the refugee provisions. So it really does impose a stay on the heart of the executive order with regards to the ability of individuals from these seven countries to enter the United States at this time.
So even that indefinite ban on Syrian refugees is now being temporarily stayed?
That's correct, yeah. So the stay applies to the immigrant and non-immigrant visa holder ban, as well as the sections of the executive order that apply to the Syrian refugees and to other refugees who are temporarily banned. Those all have been stayed, especially as there were provisions with regards to the refugees that favored non-Muslims. So in effect, the executive order put a ban on the entry of all refugees from these seven Muslim majority countries, but those provisions provided an exception, gave discretion to consular official officers and others to admit refugees who were of a minority religion in these countries. So essentially everyone who was not Muslim. So those provisions have all been stated as of now. Of course, we do know that the government immediately appealed. It has gone up to the Ninth Circuit. The briefs on the case are due today. And so we would expect a ruling from the Ninth Circuit very shortly. And I would imagine that whatever way the Ninth Circuit rules, that there will be an appeal to the Supreme Court. So if the Ninth Circuit lifts the stay, then of course, all of those provisions of the ban would go back into place. So a lot of back and forth and a lot of confusion and uncertainty for families in the U.S. and around the world.
So as of now, are people being allowed in if they land at an international airport with a valid visa or a refugee asylum claim?
So as of now, yes, that is generally what we have seen taking place. We have had attorneys at the airport every day since the ban, and so we're closely trying to monitor the situation. I spoke with my colleague who was at the airport yesterday and heard from this morning as well that the wait times have been drastically reduced and people generally are being allowed into the country without incident. So it's heartening to see that despite Trump's comments to the contrary, that the agencies at least seem to be complying with the judge's order at this time. This was not the case in the week preceding the Washington state order, in which there were numerous examples of the agencies simply disregarding, for example, the New York ruling, the Darwish ruling that came down as a result of an ACLU lawsuit on Saturday, the 28th, the day after the executive order was issued.
So does that mean that those people who had valid visas were turned away and are getting on flights now will be let in? If so, does it also mean that there is a window currently open that could close anytime, depending on how the Ninth Circuit rules, and if people, you know, were turned away, that now's the time to make their travel plans in the next, you know, few days or so?
Well, you know, I think that the time to make the travel plan was yesterday or the day before, because, like I said, the last legal briefs are due today in the
today,
Ninth Circuit.
Meaning Monday, the day we're recording
exactly.
This interview, Monday. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yes, today to Monday. We don't know when the Ninth Circuit will make their ruling, and if they choose to lift the stay, then we're going to be back in the place that we were on the weekend right. After the executive order went into effect. We have a client, for example. She had a valid student visa. It's called an F1 visa, a Syrian national, and she was turned away the weekend after the executive order was issued, and her visa was supposedly revoked, and we were able to successfully get her back in the country. So there are examples of that having happened, but it was because immediately after the Washington ruling came down, you know, we were on the phone with her saying, get your plane ticket, get back on the plane. We will, you know, work with you to get you back in the country. And so, you know, that's a success story. But for those who were turned away and who have not yet boarded a plane, you know, the window is, we don't know when that window is closing,
right.
But they should really pay attention and purchase their ticket as quickly as possible, especially if the Ninth Circuit continues the stay and then it gets appealed to the Supreme Court, that extends that window of time.
Right. And so there have been a number of folks that have been able to enter the country who were initially denied. One of the first, if not the first, was an Iranian man named Ali Vayaghan, who was allowed to enter the country at LAX. That was last week, actually. Lots of journalists, even the mayor of LA showed up. An Iranian student, and then the woman that you mentioned. What has the airport been like in the last few weeks? Of course, and I can imagine that there have been similar scenes playing out at major international airports around the country. You've been at LAX, one of this kind of army of lawyers that have deployed themselves to help defend folks. Can you give us a sense of what it's been like there?
Sure. Well, it's been chaotic, to say the least. On the one hand, it's been incredible to see the number of lawyers and volunteers and activists and protesters who have come out and really organized together to fight this ban. But there's just been a lot of confusion, a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. Family members waiting for hours and hours, in some cases over 24 hours, for their loved ones. After the executive order was issued, and even after the Darwish stay was issued in out of New York City on the 28th of January, you know, CBP was not complying and they were continuing to detain people for extended periods of time without the ability to communicate with their families or with attorneys. We know that at LAX, for example, they had an entirely separate room, a separate facility inside the customs area where they would just shuttle all of the people from these seven countries and make them wait in this area without being able to use the cell phone. They couldn't go to the restroom without being escorted by a CBP official. There were no beds there. There was food and there were snacks, although we did hear reports that if you took a snack, they wrote your name down as if they were recording the food that you were eating. There was just a lot of fear. There was, you know, we had a story of a Iranian grandmother. She was, I believe, 78 years old, coming to the U.S. to visit her 10 children, all of whom are U.S. citizens, as well as meet many grandchildren that she had never met because it had been so long since they had seen each other. And she fell ill while in CBP custody. CBP, in fact, was required to call an ambulance to assist her, and yet they still wouldn't release her, and they still kept her overnight. She was in custody for over 26 hours. And so you can just imagine that.
That's barbaric. That's just barbaric.
And this was after the Darwish order out of New York came down. We know that CBP officials were also coercing people into signing away some of their rights. You know, they were coercing them into signing what we call withdrawal of their application for admission. If you imagine that every time you enter an airport internationally, you are sort of knocking on a door asking to be admitted to that country, there are forms which you can sign to withdraw and say, oh no, even though I bought a $1,000 plus ticket and I spent 20 hours on a plane after arriving at LAX, I have somehow changed my mind and I no longer want to enter the United States and see my family. We know that some people signed these forms, and there's no other reason except for coercion that they would have signed these forms. And this was a way for CBP to do an end run around the Darwish order that prohibited CBP from deporting people. And so we believe, although they haven't said anything, that their logic was, well, if we're not deporting these people, if they voluntarily, quote unquote, sign away their application for admission. So really just a lot of confusion. CBP would not talk to us. They still have not provided us a list of names of individuals that they held or may have signed any of these forms. So really a lot of it's like a black box in there. It's really hard to get information.
So on this issue of those people, and I'm sure there's probably no way to find out exactly how many those people who, and I heard those same reports, who were essentially asked to deport themselves effectively, does the Robart ruling mean they can come back in, or will they have to sort of litigate, you know, the signing away of their rights individually?
So, unfortunately, I think is not completely clear. So Sara Yarjani, the Syrian national that was this student that I described earlier, who we were able to successfully have return from abroad after, she actually signed one of these forms. And so that was a case where it was immediately sort of it was never put into effect. That withdrawal was in effect revoked. But these are scenarios where there is confusion because there were other people, for example, who had cancellation stamps placed into their passports or their visas. Even though the administration has now said that those cancellations, those revocations are no longer valid, because of the Washington state ruling, we have heard stories of individuals who were unable to get either embassy officials to give them a valid visa, you know, without the cancellation stamps, or where they were not allowed to board flights because the airlines wouldn't let them on because of that stamp in their passport. This is sort of a more smaller group of people, but there's definitely still some confusion around that particular subset of groups of people that have been affected by this.
Caitlin, what do you make of our president's tweets? I mean, we basically find out how he's feeling about things rather than from press conferences through his Twitter feed. And I'll just read out a few for our audience and you. The first one, where he said, the opinion of the so-called judge, which essentially takes law enforcement away from our country, is ridiculous and will be overturned. Then he said, it's interesting that certain Middle Eastern countries agree with the ban. He might be referring to Saudi Arabia and the UAE that were not on the ban list, the banned list. And then he said, when a country is no longer able to say who can and cannot come in and out, especially for reasons of safety and security, big trouble. He also went on to say that, I just cannot believe a judge would put our country in such peril. If something happens, blame him and the court system. People pouring in, bad. He seems to imply that if there is, you know, some kind of terrorist attack that happens tomorrow, that it's going to be the fault of this judge.
Well, you know, Sonali, all I can say is that we need to wait and see how much of his rhetoric gets placed into action and into policy and into law.
I mean, he called him so-called judge. What the hell does that mean?
Yeah.
He's a judge. He was appointed by George W. Bush. A so-called president might be more appropriate.
I think one of the more disturbing things to come out of this entire fiasco, this entire really tragedy, is the apparent lack of respect for the three branches of government and our democratic system that we have in place. It's, you know, it's the bedrock of our government that we have three different branches that can each check each other. And it's the judicial branch's job to ensure that the executive branch doesn't overreach, and the same with the legislative branch. It's incredibly dangerous if we have a president who seems to be implying that he may not need to respect the order that judges bring down. I mean, the judicial branch doesn't have its own enforcement arm. It doesn't have, you know, a police force or an army. That's entrusted to the executive branch. We really rely on the executive branch to honor and respect the role that the judicial branch plays in interpreting the laws. So if there were, you know, a tragic situation of a terrorist attack perpetrated by an individual from one of these seven countries, it would not be because of the judge's ruling. It would be because that, you know, the laws of our country require that we not disfavor one religion, and we not treat people from one religious background differently than the other. I mean, that's the First Amendment right there, is the and the Equal Protection Clause. So I think it's really troubling, but we just have to wait and see, because as I said, despite what Trump might be saying, CBP does seem to, the most part, be complying with the judge's order. And so we're very, very heartened about that, because that was not the case in the week prior.
Briefly, if this does go up to the Supreme Court, which it in all likelihood will, is it likely it would end up at the Supreme Court before Neil Gorsuch is cleared to take on that empty spot left by Antonin Scalia, or will it be ruled on by an 8-person court? And if so, there might be deadlock. You know, it's all sorts of sort of legal things that are up in the air.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of uncertainty. You know, it just depends on how long the confirmation process plays out. You know, we know that in other, at least in the cabinet context, that the Republicans have taken steps to make it easier for them to just confirm individuals without without the input of the Democrats, so to speak. But we don't know what they're going to be doing with the Supreme Court nominee. You know, he does require confirmation by the Senate, and so just depending on how long that takes place, you're right. We don't know. And if it does come in front of an 8-judge panel and it's a 4-4 split, then that would mean that the ruling of the Ninth Circuit panel would rule the day for now. So yeah, we don't know how that's going to play out.
A lot of uncertainty. Caitlin, I want to thank you and all the attorneys at the ACLU and other lawyers who've been doing such important work. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Caitlin Sanderson is a staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California, Orange County office. She's also founding board president of the Immigrant Defenders Law Center. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find our interviews online at risingupwithsonali.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.